ladies and gentlemen, during the last two decades, what the Enlightenment relegated to the stigmatized irrational periphery of human life, I'm talking about emotion, affect, passion, and so on, has gradually returned center stage. In the social sciences, the situation has started to change from the late 70s onwards, when emotions, the scandal of reason, made a miraculous comeback through the establishment of the now thriving sociology of emotions. Indeed, by taking into account emotion, affect, and passion, one may be able to reach a more thorough understanding of what sticks, both what fuels identification processes and agency, and what creates discursive fixity and sustains hegemonic structures. A Lacanian psychoanalytic approach affirms these intuitions and accepts the central role that affect, or more precisely, in the psychoanalytic vocabulary, jouissance, enjoyment, plays in accounting for the grip of identity or the vector of identifications. It is true, of course, that Lacan has been accused of neglecting the affective dimension. But this is only the case with his early work. In his mature work, with the emphasis shifting from the symbolic to the real, from language to enjoyment, Lacan's teaching will in fact allow the development of a distinct take on the nature of the so-called affective turn. Following this lead, the sociopolitical analysis inspired by Lacanian psychoanalytic theory, cannot remain solely at the level of meaning or signification. If so, how should one theorize the material irreducible to signification? Here, I think that one needs to stress the productivity of the Lacanian distinction between the subject of the signifier, on the one hand, and the subject of enjoyment, of jouissance, on the other. Lacan posits jouissance as always already lost, as the part of ourselves subjected to symbolic castration, the part of ourselves that upon entering socialization processes is sacrificed so that the social subject proper may emerge. However, this prohibition of enjoyment, the nodal point of the Oedipal drama, is exactly what permits the emergence of desire. A desire structured around the unending quest for the lacking jouissance. When subjectivity is conceived in terms of lack, then, you must have heard about the Lacanian subject of lack, then this lack should be understood as a lack of enjoyment, as a lack of jouissance. However, the fact that this enjoyment, in its pre-symbolic fullness, this pre-symbolic excess, which is sacrificed in socialization. The fact that this enjoyment is ultimately lacking for the social subject does not mean that it stops influencing processes of identification. On the contrary, it may even be possible, starting from this premise, to introduce a complex typology of the modes of interaction between enjoyment and the discursive dialectics of sociopolitical identification. What is the first step in this typology? For a start, it is the imaginary promise of recapturing our last impossible enjoyment, which provides the fantasy support for many of our political projects, our social roles, and consumer choices. A good portion of political discourse focuses, for example, on the delivery of the good life or a just society, both of them fictions, imaginarizations of a future state in which the current limitations thwarting, obstructing our enjoyment will be eventually overcome. The politics of utopia provides the exemplary case of the structure I'm trying to describe here. But this is, of course, this is not the full story. There is a second step involved. What sustains desire and motivates our acts of identification at an affective level is not merely reducible to some abstract, phantasmatic promise of fullness. This desire motivation is sustained also by the subject's limit experiences linked to an enjoyment of the body. Without such experiences, our faith in phantasmatically inflected political projects, projects which never manage to deliver the fullness they promise, would gradually vanish. If we turn our attention to national identifications, as an example, as a suitable example, practices of celebration associated with the defeat of a national enemy, the success of a national football team, are examples of such experiences, momentary experiences of partial enjoyment. Again, however, this is not enough. This is never enough. Something is still missing, which creates the need for a third step, which takes me to the third step of this typology. Indeed, oftentimes, it makes sense from the point of view of the reproduction of a particular ideology or hegemonic order to attribute the cause of this persisting lack of enjoyment to someone, to an evil agent, who has allegedly stolen it. It may be a foreign occupier, it may be those who always plot to rule the world, some dark powers and their local sympathizers who want to enslave our proud nation, it may be immigrants who steal our jobs, and so on and so forth. In this view, the obstacle to full enjoyment shifts depending on the specificity of the narrative at stake, but the formal logic remains the same. Such fantasies of the theft of enjoyment, as Slavoj Žižek has described them, are often crucial in structuring a salient identification around our missing enjoyment itself and around the affective intensity of hatred towards the one who is supposedly to blame for our limited access to it. As we have seen then, a plurality of distinct but interimplicated levels, symbolic, imaginary, and affective, is always involved in a successful identification, regulating social and political behavior. Indeed, every age, every historical conjuncture, every sociopolitical order will institute their own blend of coercion, symbolic authority, phantasmatic and partial jouissance, as well as their own staging of the theft of enjoyment. All that in a bid to control social and political life and channel behavior into predictable patterns. Economy is no exception. It is such a sedimented system that seems to be in crisis today, together with the types of subjectivity it produced and encouraged. In this sense, the global crisis is not economic only in the strict sense of the word. Or rather, the economy which is being disturbed is not only that of the banks and financial institutions, the economy of growth and employment, the economy of production and consumption of commodities, for example. It is, above and beyond all that, the biopolitical economy of producing and consuming types of social beings, types of subjectivity, patterns of behavior, workers and consumers. It is a psychic economy, as Freud would put it. It is a libidinal economy, to use Lyotard's expression. It is an affective economy in the vocabulary of Norbert Elias. What is in crisis, in other words, is the mode of domination, of regulation and control that hegemonized our globalized world and determined the types of subjectivity it constructed and disseminated. In my view, it is impossible to understand the current crisis without dealing with economy in this broader sense. A move returning us to a type of argumentation thriving up until almost 100 years ago. And I'm referring, of course, to good old political economy and the critique of political economy. Besides, it is also not a coincidence, it is also far from a coincidence, that founding figures of sociological thought, like Max Weber, but also Werner Zombart and Thorsten Veblen, considered necessary to analyze the spiritual preconditions of capitalism and of its reproduction. Mind you, reference to spirit within this framework has no idealist or mysticist sense or meaning. According to Max Weber, spirit implies a particular form of obligation, a distinct ethical mode, a type of categorical imperative. We should view this spirit as framing and orienting, among others, our economic behavior, investing it with socially acceptable meanings and affective intensities, placing it within a broader libidinal affective economy, and thus stabilizing particular modes of production, consumption and reproduction, particular modes of power and domination. And to say a couple of words about Greece, it is not, again, a coincidence, I think, that many analysts have argued that the logic behind the agreement, the memorandum, mnemonion, between the Greek government, the International Monetary Fund, and the European Union is not, the logic behind it is not an economic logic in the strict sense of the term, but rather a logic of biopolitical domination, an attempt to redraw the terms of reproduction of a variety of aspects of social life, including working conditions, intergenerational solidarity, the administration of knowledge, and so on and so forth. Along these lines, we can risk, I think, the hypothesis that, above all else, today's crisis constitutes a symptom, the final outcome, of an ethical and cultural transformation, of a spiritual transformation that took place after the Second World War. Using the analysis of Todd McGowan, we can speak about a passage from a society of prohibition to a society of commanded enjoyment. From prohibition to commanded enjoyment. While more traditional forms of social organization, including capitalism up until the Second World War, required subjects to renounce the private enjoyment in the name of social duty, today, as McGowan tells us, the only duty seems to consist in enjoying oneself as much as possible. This is the call that was, and to a certain extent, is still addressed to us from all sides, the media, advertisements, even our own friends. Societies of prohibition were founded on an idealization of sacrifice, of sacrificing enjoyment for the sake of social duty. This is the first spirit of capitalism, associated with a sense of professional duty based on rational asceticism, a gradually secularized version of Protestant asceticism, and the concomitant tabooing of enjoyment and conspicuous consumption, as well as luxury. In our societies of commanded enjoyment, the private enjoyment that threatened the stability of the society of prohibition becomes a stabilizing force and even acquires the duty, the status of a duty itself. Hence, the domination of consumerist hedonism, of the unending quest for individual enjoyment at all costs. And this cost is social, is personal, is ecological, and so on and so forth. This, in the fewest words possible, is the so-called second spirit of capitalism. And obviously, today's crisis is a crisis of this model. Now, let me try to highlight the complexities involved in the relation between the two spirits, these two spirits, the first spirit of capitalism, the second spirit of capitalism, society of prohibition on the one hand, society of commanded enjoyment on the other. I want to highlight the complexities both at the synchronic and the diachronic level. As we have seen, from a psychoanalytic point of view, every society has to come to terms with the impossibility of attaining jouissance as fullness. It is only the fantasies produced and circulated to mask or at least to domesticate this trauma at both the symbolic and affective levels that can vary and in fact do vary immensely. Now, prohibition and commanded enjoyment are two distinct such strategies designed to institute the social bond and legitimize authority, social hierarchy, and power in different ways. Nevertheless, in both cases, certain things remain unchanged. What remains the same is, first of all, the impossibility of realizing the fantasy. Commanded enjoyment has not brought us closer to recapturing our lost, castrated selves. But if this is the case, then the command to enjoy is only revealed as a more nuanced form of prohibition. It continues with other means the traditional function of symbolic law and power. Indeed, from a Lacanian point of view, what we have here is two versions of the superego, a superego that not only prohibits but also commands us to enjoy. Lacan was, in fact, one of the first to detect in this innocent call, this request to enjoy, the unmistakable mark of power and authority. Thus, Lacan is offering a revealing insight on what has been described as the consuming paradox. While consumerism seems to broaden our opportunities, choices, and experiences as individuals, it also directs us towards predetermined channels of behavior, and thus it is ultimately as constraining as it is enabling. Now, if it is a mistake to understand the two spirits in purely antithetical terms, the one as constraining and the other as liberating, it is also insufficient to think of them in terms of linear succession. In fact, it would be a mistake to associate the emergence of and force of commanded enjoyment with modernity itself. This is clearly not the first time in history that such an order of commanded enjoyment was instituted. It is in fact possible to trace the genealogy of this administration of enjoyment, of such an authority and phantasmatic structure, back to what is often called the court society. European aristocracy, the feudal ruling class, asserted itself through its devotion to leisure and the unproductive and conspicuous consumption of goods and luxuries. However, one should not mistake the wealth of members of this class with a state of perfect happiness free from all social restraint. On the contrary, as Norbert Elias has masterfully shown, a powerful ethics of obligation is operating here. What appears as extravagance from the standpoint of the bourgeois economic ethic of the first spirit of capitalism is in reality the expression of the seigneurial ethos of rank. It is not freely chosen. Indeed, expenditure on prestige and display is for the upper classes of the times a necessity which they cannot avoid. According to Werner Zombart, this ethos of commanded enjoyment emerges with court society and then passes gradually to parts of the bourgeoisie through the amalgamation of noble ancestry and bourgeois money, an account corroborated by more recent historical research. From such a point of view, what the post-war period marks is only the last act of the drama, as it signals an unprecedented hegemonization of social life by consumerism and the ethics of enforced enjoyment at a mass scale, a democratization of conspicuous consumption. This was, I think, the way in which the hegemonic system managed to co-opt the egalitarian dynamics of a variety of struggles and demands, in a way reproducing instead of undermining itself, especially after May 68. It is this strategy, however, that seems to be reaching its limits today. The current economic crisis has turned, or is turning currently, the center of gravity back to the value of prohibition and sacrifice, to the value of cuts. And not only cuts, not only regarding wages and pensions, welfare provision and future expectations, but on a much wider cultural scale. To give you an example, when I started writing this talk, my newspaper reported the theme of a public discussion organized in the framework of a local book fair. The title was Youth and Books, From Obligation to Enjoyment, and that was indicative of the shift in strategies of socialization towards a more permissive commanded enjoyment model. Now that I am finishing this paper, mainstream news websites host articles with titles such as Recession, How to Talk to Your Kids, articles in which experts provide advice to parents on how to start saying no to their children, something indicative of the reverse trend. And all that at a moment when member states of the European Union are called to incorporate the Protestant spirit of asceticism in their constitutions. Only time, of course, will show where exactly this dialectic will lead in the next period and in favor of whom. It is, however, extremely important to realize that our choices are not limited to these two spirits that I have tried to present in this talk. How is that? Well, and now I'm reaching the end of my argument, a more careful analysis reveals that prohibition and commanded enjoyment coexisted almost from the beginning, constituting a pendulum of mutual engagement. As we have seen, of course, most analysts locate the shift from the first to the second spirit of capitalism around the middle of the 20th century. According to most accounts, it is in the second half of 20th century after 1950 that Puritanism gives place to enjoyment. Recent research, however, has revealed that whatever forces were working to challenge the Protestant ethic, they were hardly recent, but could be found to have a pedigree which extended back to a time well before the 20th century. This is a point made very forcefully by Colin Campbell. Indeed, signs of erosion of the first spirit of capitalism started to become visible and conscious well before that. Writing in 1880, Lafargue, Karl Marx's son-in-law, describes vividly how mass production prepared the ground for the development of a consumer culture unified around the command to enjoy. It could even be argued that the first wave of hedonism and consumerism affected the middle ranks of English society by the second half of the 18th century. Drawing on and renewing a neglected tradition going back to Zombart's work, recent historical research has documented an unparalleled product and consumer revolution that took place in 18th century Britain. Far from being the invention of the post-Cold War era, a global consumer society is thus revealed as the very foundation of the industrial world. The domination of the bourgeois secularized asceticism of prohibition did not take place in a vacuum. It hegemonized the field, struggling against countervailing powers without whom it would never acquire its urgent dynamic. Powers, forces with which it constitutes a functional double and without which it could never function. In order for the system to be functional, for those who save, for those who accumulate, for those who invest and produce, there must be even more that consume. So, in that sense, we have to do with a pendulum of countervailing forces that only in their mutual engagement have managed to control society and to safeguard, to maintain their production and the renewal of capitalism, and also to co-opt tensions and egalitarian demands. Of course, today, as I have already mentioned, we seem to be going through a change in the center of gravity of the system from commanded enjoyment, from this soft version of biopolitical domination back to prohibition. And of course, in order to make this passage more convincing, what is needed is the stigmatization of some bad guys who are to blame for the theft of our enjoyment, for the bankruptcy of the spirit of commanded enjoyment, so that cuts, austerity, emerge as the only rational solution. Such a stigmatization takes place in terms of a social pathology disseminated by the media. And this mechanism encompasses today a variety of different fields. The field of subjectivity itself, we have the clash between different types of superego, superego of prohibition with the superego of commanded enjoyment. It encompasses intersubjective relations within the family. Certain generations are closer to the one model, while other generations are closer to the other model. It also encompasses relations between social groups and social classes. One group demonizes the other before itself is demonized. But it also encompasses relations between states. And here we have distinction between pigs and all the rest. Is it possible to escape this double, this pendulum? Can such an attempt succeed? Will it become possible to escape the vicious cycle of prohibition and commanded enjoyment? This is, for me, the major challenge lying ahead of us. Thank you very much.